Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we share a little bit about our still-in-process TGFBI drafts, play a little guessing game with our numbers of the week, talk about players with some nice under-the-hood stats who just need a chance to play more regularly, understanding media reporting and sourcing around the CBA negotiations, and so much more. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
Not so bad. So, weird story for tonight, immediately.
Yes, always down for weird stories. Yeah.
I got caught in traffic on the way home because of the State of the Union tonight and, like, had to route myself around the U.S. Capitol in a really weird way. and it never occurred to me that I needed to not drive directly towards the U.S. Capitol while the State of the Union was about to happen. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. That ever
I imagine
to you
that
before?
There are some people who take that pretty seriously. Does Waze have an avoid the State of the Union button? Probably not. Right?
It does not. I can tell you from experience. No.
You can avoid freeways, but you can't avoid really large, important gatherings of the heads of all of our government, except for the one who's in a bunker somewhere.
Yeah, I actually didn't look up who the designated survivor is tonight, and I probably owe it to myself to do that, but that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, we probably should do that. I should probably know that, honestly, but I don't, so...
Is that like a trivia question you can do for... Yeah, you should know that for class tomorrow, right?
I think we should... Yeah, I should bring that into my class tomorrow. So while Alexander is furiously typing... maybe people don't know when the State of the Union happens, everybody in our government is in one place. So in order to protect against a doomsday scenario where, as the TV show named Designated Survivor, posits, there's some sort of an attack or mishap where all of our government officials are, incapacitated. I'll use that word, incapacitated all at once. One member of the cabinet every single time that we do the State of the Union is the designated survivor and does not attend and is holed up somewhere safe so that that person would automatically become president of the United States and try and rebuild our government. It's fascinating stuff. So who was the selected designated survivor for tonight?
It is Gita Raimondo. She's the commerce secretary. Do you have any idea what she did before?
No.
Oh, man. Okay. She's from Rhode Island or something like that. I think she was a governor there. Any case, Kiefer Sutherland is not the designated survivor for real life. Yes,
thank goodness for that in real life.
Yeah. In the event that our entire government got like space jammed or whatever, you know, they all lost their ability to do whatever. So, yeah, I don't know.
There's your civics lesson for the night. Yeah, and we almost couldn't record. Yeah, I mean, just for the record, obviously, we're talking about the State of the Union tonight. We're recording on Tuesday. You're listening on Friday or beyond, so it's a few days lag there, as you well know. But very interesting start, and I think we're going to just forego the weather conversation in favor of the State of the Union conversation. I think that's a nice way to just leave it.
Weather and traffic on the twos, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, they do go hand in hand. All right. We talked about Raz Slam last week when we had Mike Carter on, and we talked with him a little bit. He's not a participant this year, and so we were able to kind of talk rules with somebody who hadn't studied them and made a sheet and all of that. I think it was really, really interesting. This week, as most of you listening probably know, TGFBI has kicked off. Both Alexander and I are participating in that this year. I believe, again, both of us for the first time. Am I wrong about that, Alexander?
That is correct. I did not sign up last year.
Last year, I didn't even know I could. I was so new, and boy, I would have been in way over my head. I'm still in way over my head. I just am. But last year would have been even more challenging for me. So we're both rookies in TGFBI this year. You are picking from what spot in your league?
I am on the 12 spot, and that's from a 15 team league. So that does not mean I am literally on the turn. It's like there's two other people or three other people. Like after the turn that like get to snipe me, and then it comes back to the 12 spot turn traditionally.
Just
in my
enough
mind.
Spots where you're like, there's these four guys I like. They might not all come back. Yeah, it's tough. I'm picking at 13, so it's a little bit better, but same idea.
Yeah. I'm doing this really crazy thing also where I am daring myself to spend a total of 0 seconds on the clock. So I have auto-picked every single time by setting my queue ahead of time. So that means every time I have to have a contingency plan and feel confident in it. And the nice thing is that I'm actually lying to myself and eventually I will stop. But it's been a really fun bit and I felt like a great league mate as a result. So.
Yeah, people won't be that. That's maybe actually a very interesting conversation. Where do you stand on the slowness of a slow draft?
I'm fine with it as long as you're being reasonable. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah,
people like have to wait. If it's every pick, that's one thing. If it's like the very first pick, for example, that's also not a thing that I'm not a big fan of. But like, let's say that you're on the turn and you don't actually know what you want to do there, and like you need to adjust because you're not sure who's going to make it back. That's one thing. So it's like the guys who like take forever for pick five. That's the only real gripe. But I also like have done more than a few of like the just absolutely insane. You have 45 seconds to pick like Yahoo mocks in the past that just like fry my brain like speed chess. So I get why you wouldn't want to do that to yourself.
Right. I appreciate the long, slow draft form. It does get a little tedious sometimes if you have a bunch of guys taking a couple of hours on each pick. But, I mean, so in Razzslam, my average pick time was way high at the beginning because the clock stops at 2 a.m. Eastern time, which is the zone we're in. And so I like have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm not staying up until 2. So it didn't look like my pick was going to come just the way that we had done pacing. And it must have at like 11:15 or something after I'd gone to bed. And so I sat on the clock till 2, got up, made my pick as soon as I saw that I was on the clock. But it started me at like a 2.5 hour thing. So I understand that different people in different time zones, you know, sleeping and working and stuff. Today, I was on the clock in TGFBI right as one of my classes was about to start, and it's a back-to-backer. And all you teachers out there, you understand that even though you have a changeover from one class to the next, it's 3 minutes, like literally for me, 3 minutes. It's never even enough time to make a quick run to the bathroom, let alone sit down and try and make a pick. So what I did is I went into the chat that we have, the group chat on Twitter, and I just said, look, I'm sorry, but this one's probably going to take me a couple of hours just to get done because I'm working, I'm teaching. And so at the very least, I feel like if I'm being a little obnoxious in terms of the time, I'm being courteous in terms of people not sitting there twiddling their thumbs thinking that at any moment I could pick when I know full well it's not happening for a little bit. So I try and at least alert people to what's going on. It's tough. I'm the pace of my Razzslam is such that there's a chance that the TGFBI draft, 30 rounds, right? Do I have that right in my head?
Yeah.
It's 30 rounds. Razzslam's 42. Because of the pacing, even though it's 12-team Razzslam, 15-team TGFBI, there's a chance my TGFBI draft is going to finish first. It might be a little bit of a horse race, which is interesting. It's not a criticism. It's just, I don't know, I find that interesting. There are definitely people, though, that are like way up in arms about people who take more than even a half hour when it's a four-hour clock. So, I try and put myself in their position, I suppose. If you feel like you're waiting 3 hours for every pick, that gets to be a little bit tough. But I'd rather the 3 hours per pick and just roll with it and understand that that's going to happen than those 30-second, 45-second stress fests. My goodness, by the time I'm done with those, I probably lost years off the end of my life. So
yeah.
I will definitely take the slow format, even if it's extra slow over all that. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you started from the 12 spot? I think people find that interesting.
Yeah, this has been a really weird draft. I find the most fun I have from TGFBI is, one, trying to wrap my head around like the implicit assumptions that like a closer in a second requires you to like believe in. Like, dear God, I don't get it. but also like just seeing all the creative like pairings and things people do. Before I talk about mine, my favorite thing is Jordan Rosenblum, Jordan Finland, if you're familiar with him, double tap catcher in the third and fourth round, getting Sal Perez and then Will Smith. So he and I have been like joking that we hate each other in the process of like getting ready for this league. And I think I may have accidentally goaded him into doing that. And I'm really proud of him. But out of the 12th spot, Garrett Cole fell to me. I was really happy there. I had him about fifth on my board. And then I picked up Rafael Devers on the other side. He was about 15th on my board, maybe a little higher because there were some catchers really high that I was like, I don't really believe that. And then like I didn't draft.
They were really
based on
high
that.
On mine too. I'm sure your list for this was far more comprehensive than mine. But I looked at it and I was like, man, those catchers. It's got to be positional scarcity, right? That's driving up their price.
Think about it.
Significantly.
What's the difference between Sal Perez and the 24th best catcher? And then think to yourself, what's the difference between, let's say, for example, Rafael Devers and the last third baseman that's going to go? The statistical difference is larger for Sal Perez. Now,
yeah, it's a catcher league, but just for those who don't know, yeah.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And so I had like Perez like in the top 10 of my draft ranks, but I knew the people wouldn't draft like that. So I risked that I wouldn't be able to get Perez. And I ended up with Real Matua in the fourth or in the third. So yeah, that was my third pick. Feel really great about that. I got Buxton on the wraparound there. He was a guy that was in my top 40 by earned values. And I know I'm going to have a very safe bench and end of the draft, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to take my risks up top. And then I got Brandon Lau, also a guy who is roughly in my top 50 or so at pick roughly 67 or whatever it is. No. That is pick 60. Nope, I can't.
Come on, math man.
72. I got him at 72, and I'm in the top 50. And then I got Joe Musgrove, who I think could be a top 15 starter again. So I'm really happy with all of the picks I have made in a combined 0 seconds on the clock.
Combined 0 seconds is huge, because here's the thing, and kind of going back, I guess, a little bit to the clock thing, but people, Nick is famous for this. Set your cue. Maybe it's just because this is not necessarily my strength to be able to tell the future that some in the way that some other people can or seem to be able to, but I want to see the board. I want to know, like, I've set my cue to grab a pitcher, but then, you know, like, there's this run on third baseman or something. Do I want to adjust, or do I want closers, or, you know, do I need to zig instead of zag where I thought I could do one thing and things have changed, or you know, whatever the case is, especially if the let's say the first three people in my queue are gone, now I'm to my fourth guy. Is that really the guy I want, depending upon how things shaped up? So I don't know. I guess there are some people out there, you included at this point, who are better at being able to anticipate those chess moves three or four down the line. That's definitely not my strength. I'm much more of a, I'd like to see the landscape before me before I click that button whenever possible.
Yeah, one of the difficulties with predicting what people are going to do is you have to like either predict that someone is going to be rational, which is wrong, or that you're going to have to predict that they're going to be stupid, which is itself unpredictable. Like, for example, the guy who was had the first pick in my league, pick Tatis, which is, I guess, kind of rare, actually. Most people pick Turner, but then he picked Wander Franco with the 30th overall pick or on the turn. So he back-to-back shortstops. And
yeah,
like, arguable reach on the first one, significant and inexplicable reach on the second one. There are things like that on every single TGFBI board.
Sure.
So what I find is that on average, TGFBI ADP is an interesting indication of where the market's feeling about different players. You then look at the boards and you realize, oh, there are a lot of people who are doing some just absolutely insane things. Like the guy in my league who took Liam Hendricks and then Raisel Iglesias in the second and third rounds. Or, you know, you can go up and down the board. Someone will say that double tapping catchers is an insane thing. I don't know. I'm probably going to try to hit a second catcher by the 15th round. I would love to get like Mitch Garver or something like that. You know, someone mm-hmm. I know that I trust, that would be ideal. So like, you know, stupid it is in the eye of the beholder, but like,
absolutely. And some people are willing to do things that are quote unquote stupid for content, or because, you know, they've done a bunch of pay leagues and, or, you know, a bunch of DCs or whatever. And this is this is not a a buy-in league, and they have the freedom to do something, and they want to go all in. And so they do something that's crazy enough to be, you know, is going to help them finish first or last. It was interesting when we talked to Justin Mason about like some of the conventional wisdom around this and seeing some people kind of follow it and some people not, you know, go against it. It's been very interesting. I'll run down my picks here real quick. I'm right now, we're in the, let's see, the, it says it's in round and then it doesn't tell me. So where are left we side. At? Just, yeah, my screen is small because I'm trying to see our conversation at the same time. So we're in the seventh.
Okay.
Seventh round. It's coming up to me. We're on pick nine in the seventh. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 players obviously on my team, and I've got 3 picks till it's my turn again. I got Devers at 13. I actually was pretty pleased. I was torn. It was funny. At 13, I was very torn between a bunch of different players because when you're playing in a 15 team league and you're not used to it, those later first round, quote unquote, first round guys don't feel like first round guys. Mm-hmm. I think I was down to between Devers and Tucker. Part of me regrets not grabbing Kyle Tucker, who went 14. The pick was probably Betts until Eno Saris took Betts. So if Eno took him, he definitely was the pick. but third base is kind of a wasteland pretty quickly. So I didn't want to be in the Bregman Arenado range where you're still investing a bunch of draft capital without as much certainty. So I was pretty happy getting Devers at 13. Coming back, I grabbed Scherzer. Then in the third round, I grabbed Salvi. I absolutely hate taking catchers early in drafts. But I do think that that's where the value is here. Now, a lot of the NFBC stuff that's been going on has seen these closers going so early because they're not FOB leagues. This is. So it does surprise me a little bit that closers still were going so ridiculously early. And I think that if they're doing that, you're losing some of the value in the discrepancy because of the opportunity cost. But catcher, I think, is one of those places where you still can kind of make that up. So I got Sal Perez there in the third. I followed that up with Matt Olson. So my corners are pretty stocked.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if Olsen gets traded out of Oakland and into a better hitting situation, which is almost anywhere else. I grabbed Chapman on the way back because I just didn't want to be super desperate for saves later on, although I don't love his profile. I feel like if he falters at all, the Yankees are going to be quick to take one of the other three guys that could easily fill the role. But value wise, it made sense. So I went away from my heart with that one and with my brain. And then coming back, I got Varsho. I double tapped catcher. So I've got 2 before my seventh round pick. But with Varsho, you get a little bit more versatility too. So I don't know. It's been very, very interesting doing that with catcher. I feel like now I'm going to be chasing a lot of steals and saves, especially since I'm not super convinced Chapman is all that solid. I think the pick was the right pick logically, but I had to kind of hold my nose a little bit and do it. I don't know. We'll see how things shape up as this goes on. And to your point, some people are doing some crazy things. You know, Josh Hader went in the second round in our draft. You know, this the same person who took Hader in the second round. It started with Burns, then went Judge, Mondesi, Springer, Brandon Lau. So there's some definite risk, different kinds of risk, but risk there in going that way. But if all of those guys perform, I mean, that's a pretty good start. So I don't know. It's been a very interesting experience. One of the things I love a lot about this is that you're drafting with people who are absolutely savvy. You know that every single person has a plan, whether or not it's your plan, whether you agree with that plan or that strategy, or maybe the strategy is just, I want to be able to write a fun article about how this turns out. Everybody's doing what they're doing on purpose. And I think that that's kind of fun.
Yeah. One of the things I'm noticing, again, this is anecdotal, but it is very interesting to look at, is you have to think that some of these teams that are going double closer early are going to finish top two, top three in the category, and then just not be good teams.
It could be.
I don't have any illusions about winning the overall. I want to finish high in my league, and I think that just doing well will be good enough for me as a person. Like, if I'm in the top 100 or whatever, I've joked about being the top 50, but if I'm going to be in the top 100 overall by finishing top three in my league or so, I'll take it. I think
I have the opposite goal. I want to not finish in the bottom 100. That's
I don't think you're going to have that problem. Set your lineups every week and we'll bug each other and we'll be fine.
That's my biggest thing. I'll be honest, is staying committed throughout the year. Last year, this is going to be a serious conversation for just a second, then we can get back to the fun stuff. But last year, I had just started with Pitcher List. I felt like I should be doing better than I've ever done before. A lot of imposter syndrome with like being in there and part of it. And I actually went through this part of the season where for probably 3, 4, 5 weeks, I didn't really check lineups at all because things weren't going well. Guys got injured and it put me in this really dark place until I realized like, why are you feeling this way about this thing? I don't know if other people have similar experiences with that sort of a thing, in terms of how their mood is affected by their successes or their failures with fantasy. But I certainly did experience that. So, there are a lot of reasons why smart people don't win leagues, and this is going to put me on a small tangent, but I saw a tweet the other day that was talking about linking where people finish in leagues like TGFBI with credibility. And it's going to sound like I'm defending my own work because maybe I'm not going to finish super high in this league, but they're completely different skill sets. And just because somebody might be terrible at drafting or following through, or they have a lot of stuff that distracts them over the course of the year and they miss a few lineup locks and stuff, doesn't mean that their work is not valuable or smart. So anyway, that's a tangent.
I would say like I've definitely had some months or so at a time, especially it's like I don't want to open up the Yahoo app because I don't want to do anything at all. Generally, it's kind of like what it was for me like last year. So like yeah. I had one ESPN team and I put energy into it because I knew people in that league and I enjoyed it. But like I don't always feel the urge to just participate for participation's sake whenever I'm the only person in the league.
And it's hard when you don't feel like your team is doing well and you maybe feel like it's some sort of, I don't know, like an indictment of your ability and stuff. And then depending upon how you're wired, if you're wired like me, it takes on a life of its own and I had to get control of that. And that's a me thing. I get that. But at the end of the day, like that's just one of a thousand reasons why baseball is hard. Fantasy baseball is a marathon. Fantasy football is different. You have the time. You have the space. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's different. Mm-hmm. Baseball is relentless, and it's very easy to lose your focus over the course of a season. So anyway, I'm very interested to see how this shapes up. My goal is to not embarrass myself. Hopefully, like you said, we send each other those reminders and and when I don't feel like setting my lineup, your message is going to pop up and it's going to make me do it and things will be okay.
Yeah. I'm hoping for the best, mostly just because like I want to enjoy this. And I think that the process of not having to set up a lineup every day will be better. So I actually have, and this is a really weird choice that we've made, I have a dynasty league starting up on Fantrax where we've set our lineup settings to be about the same as NFBC. So you have a Monday lineup and you have a Friday lineup. Now for NFBC, you can only change your hitters, but we're allowing ourselves to change the pitchers as well. And I think that'll be a nice, I know that when I change my lineups, everything's the same. And that allows me to kind of think similarly in some situations rather than like having to put my brain in like 8 different places. So
yeah,
I'm excited. I really am about this season. I'm going to have 2 places where I check leagues. And I'm going to know people in every league that I'm playing in, except for Raz Slam, which doesn't count. And yeah, that's a big thing. I think we are required in a lot of ways to want to do this. And I don't think that's always easy whenever like there were just other things to do. The number of people I know who are involved in fantasy who like say, hey, I need to take a break, I overexpose myself, is really high.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's really easy to get really excited by a bunch of projects and then just realize it's like there are two hurdles for finishing it and you have something else and it just stops happening. And so this spring, I've been doing a lot of work to kind of just like finish things. And as a result, I put out some more articles about some stuff. I finished some projects. I felt a lot better about this and a lot of other work I've been doing outside of baseball adjacent stuff. And I think that this is like the this is fun, I want to do this is harder than people give credit for. And I really like it whenever that's something that we can put ourselves in position to like actually achieve. So
not that I love all these young hipster abbreviations that your generation has coined, but I think that there's a lot of FOMO around wanting to participate in the thing that everybody's doing, right? You want to, everybody's talking about Rad Slam. I want to be in it. Everybody's talking TGFBI. I want to be in it. And that's wonderful. I love that Rad Slam is very low commitment in terms of like mid season. There's a couple of fob runs and it's best ball. So, you know, that's fun because you get to do the draft and then you kind of let, get to let it do its thing. It's very easy to overcommit. It's very easy to, you know, you fall in love with a couple of players, you get them on too many teams, they get hurt, and now across the board you're struggling in different formats in different ways. I just think it's very easy to have the fun turn into a slog, and when anything turns into a slog, different people react to it in different ways. So I have no problem sharing how I reacted to it. It was not great. And so I'm putting that in the rear view, and hopefully this season is a little bit better. Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I would say kind of like a last thing there is like, I don't think, all that told, like when we're talking about like the analyst stuff, like this tells us that people are bad. There are some really interesting things though, that it could show us people are good in some different ways. So I tend to think that yes, you know, there are lots of ways to be wrong. There are only a few ways to be right in some things. And I tend to take people at their word when they say, yeah, the reason I won is because I tried really hard in these three ways. And I just know that everyone else in my league had struggled with that. So that was it. I'm not a genius. I just executed a plan that someone else laid out for me. And I've heard that from a few people, sure.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at the top and trying to dissect what somebody's path to victory was. I think that's much more telling. It's much more positive. It's much more productive than it is trying to take the other side and chase people down rabbit holes and label them as being not good or not deserving of being an industry person simply because they had an off year or a bad year, or that might not be their format or their thing. There's a lot of really smart people writing about baseball who aren't really fantasy baseball people. There's a lot of people who are industry people who aren't analysts, aren't fantasy analysts who are involved in these things. So I don't know. There's a lot going on there, and we could probably do a whole episode on that. I didn't intend on bringing us to this place, but here we are. Do want to shift into our numbers of the week segment. But before we get to that, we are going to take a very small break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we're back. Alexander, we haven't done a game in a while. I'd like to try and do a short game here so that we can get into the crux of things. But we're going to be talking today about people who have maybe undefined roles or who have been in platoons in the past or things like that. But their numbers are good, and all they really maybe need is the opportunity or a tweak from one side of the plate or the other, or you know, one side of the mound or the other. The metaphor doesn't really carry over, but you get my point. And so before we jump into all that, I want to throw this at you. This is going to be maybe sound a little convoluted, I'm cherry picking things. And I guess to a certain degree I am, because you got to make a decision at some point. So I'm going to set the parameters here. I have faith that you're going to be able to follow me, because if I can understand what I've written, you definitely can. Looking at left-handed hitters, only lefties, only against right-handed pitching. Okay. So lefties against right-handed pitching, I'm trying to catch my breath. For some reason, it escaped me, and I'm trying really hard not to cough directly into this microphone. So let me try that again. Left-handed hitters versus right-handed pitchers, minimum 100 plate appearances, WRC plus equal to or greater than 150. There are 14 of them. Some of them are names that you would believe are there, and it's not because they have splits or platoons. It's because they're lefties and they mash righties regardless, because they mash everybody. We don't have to have you guess all 14 of those players, but do you think you could throw out, let's see what we can do. Can you give me five names and hit on all five in the top 14?
Ooh, okay.
Can we do that?
I'm sure I can try.
Of course you can try. Would you like me to give you the parameters one more time before we do this? I should probably do that.
Yeah,
so
do
again,
that.
Left-handed hitters only against right-handed pitchers. Minimum 100 plate appearances, WRC plus of 150 or greater in that scenario.
Yeah, the question for me really is, can I name five consecutive lefties without screwing up? So I know there's a couple that I can probably guess. For example, I'm just going to mentally picture who is at the top of the WRC plus leaderboards for last season and is left-handed. So like, I know, for example, Bryce Harper. Like, I'm looking at a board here for NFBC, so I'm just like thinking who's left-handed at the top of the first five rounds. So Bryce Harper, let's start there.
Bryce Harper is number one on this list. His WRC plus versus right-handed hitters was 193.
Yeah, that sounds about right for him. He was finished last year at about 170 overall, so he had to be really high.
Good year. That's a big number. Harper is good.
Just to pull back a curtain for you guys for why that makes so much automatic sense. If you're a left-handed batter, a right-handed pitcher's stuff, you're going to be able to just see a little bit better and a little bit earlier compared to other people, because you're not like looking behind yourself to see it. Like if you're like facing someone who's the same handedness, like the ball is coming out like behind your back, even sometimes. It's not great. I mean, close to that at least. So if you're opposite handed, there's just like more room to see it, and also people's pitches that are their best pitches break kind of towards the plate for you instead of away from it, like towards you. So unless someone can, as we like to say, like back foot a slider, which they are usually not very good at, you're going to be swinging at stuff that is going to be some really good places or isn't someone's best pitch. So that's why that all works so well. And that's why like Harper is significantly better against righties than he is lefties. The next couple of guys, I feel like I could miss on handedness really easily, but I'm going to just do my best to get through here. Kyle Tucker?
Kyle Tucker is not in the top 14, but I'm going to give you honorable mention here because he's 15th with a WRC plus of 149.
So that is sickening.
You're very close.
The next guy I have to guess is Shohei Ohtani.
Yes, Shohei Ohtani is number 13. He was right at 150.
Okay. Well, and now comes the part where I have to, like, are these people actually left-handed or not? Because those guys I know are lefties. Is Tatis a lefty?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure he's right-handed. Yeah. I don't see him in the top on this list, so I think that's pretty strong confirmation.
Most obvious one here, Juan Soto.
Yes, Juan Soto's number two, WRC plus 181, which is interesting because he's such a beast and such a monster in the best ways possible. And Harper still beat him by 12 points. Yeah, that's crazy.
All right, Jose Ramirez?
Jose, I don't think he's lefty.
I'm going to look that one up because
I think you should look him up. He's not on this list. I can tell you that.
Okay. I'm going to go off the wall for a last official guess then. Mike Zunino.
Mike Zunino is very off the wall. I don't know if he's righty or lefty, honestly, off the top of my head.
He's a righty because he murders lefties. Okay, I got this backwards. Yeah, okay.
Yikes.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, there's a splits guy. Kyle Schwarber. Let's finish that one.
Kyle Schwarber is on the list. Number 9, 157.
Okay. I'm going to look up some people, and you're going to tell me how wrong I was about who I was overlooking then. How's that?
Listen, I'll go through the list 1 through 14. I think there are a couple of people who are interesting and a nice segue into our case study for today, our central question. So I'm going to go through the list 1 through 14. I'll give you the name and the WRC+. And then there are a couple of people I do want to circle back to because I think they're very, very interesting in terms of being so high on this leaderboard. But what does that mean for the upcoming season? So number one is Bryce Harper, as you correctly identified, WRC+, 193. Again, this is left-handed hitters against right-handed pitchers, minimum 100 plate appearances. Number two, Juan Soto at 181. Number three is Jesse Winker, 178.
Oh, yeah.
That's a nice number for Winker there. Number four, Jared Walsh, 166. Number five, Brandon Belt at 165, tied with Joey Votto at 165. Brandon, is it Lau or Low?
That one's Lau. Brandon Lau.
That one's Lau. Yeah. Okay, so Brandon Lau. Brandon, if you're listening, and I hope you are, we mean no offense. So number seven is Brandon Lau. He was at 161. Number eight, I love this. I really love this. Michael Brantley, 158. Number nine was Kyle Schwarber, 157. Brandon Crawford is number 10 at 156. Number 11, Rafael Devers at 152. Number 12 was Jason Castro at 152. I have to imagine his plate appearances were close to the 120 plate appearances. So to take that for what it's worth in that context. Number 13 is Shohei Ohtani at 150. And then number 14 was Yasmani Grandal at 150. At 149 was Tucker, Cedric Mullins at 148, Freddie Freeman at 148. And then it kind of goes from there.
Yeah. I scrolled down. I pulled this myself. Jose Ramirez is 23rd on this list. So.
Oh, there he is. He is 23rd. So you were not wrong about his handedness.
He's a switch hitter. So
where my confusion came in. Yeah. Okay. And that also probably, I mean, obviously it gives him less opportunities. It's 425 plate appearances, though.
Every single time he shows up or there's a righty on the mound, he's going to bat lefty. It's just,
of course,
allegedly helping him out.
So here are some names that jump off this list to me that are interesting. Michael Brantley is famous for being kind of batting average. But this seems like it would probably be a pretty big discrepancy between this and left-handed pitchers he's hitting against. Crawford jumps off this page. Jared Walsh jumps off this page as people who obviously were very successful in certain circumstances, but are not necessarily high on people's lists or on people's radar. So you don't have to necessarily talk about those players in particular, but I think they're a perfect segue, and you certainly can talk about those players, into our central question, which is, who are some guys that don't necessarily have great roles or opportunities or are not locked in? There's some question marks or uncertainty, but there are numbers that are encouraging that we should be paying attention to, because if they get locked in or they get that opportunity or they get that role, it could get very, very interesting. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the reason I was interested in this sort of number, and I appreciate you like throwing me through the loop for like actually having to think about who's obvious for this question, is that there are a couple different ways that sort of uncertain role, uncertain playing time situation doesn't always blossom into the perfect full breakout that you wish it does. Because, you know, and look down the sheet, things become pretty obvious. Like, for example, I've expanded this out. Gavin Sheets, oh, that's a terrible pun, is 19th on this list with the 143 WRC+. It was only 160 PAs, but like, that is really good for a guy that we don't care that much about. That is why, by the way, he is DHing for the Chicago White Sox as often as he is. Or he did, I guess. And you could not expect that Gavin Sheets would be this good in a full-time role. There's just no way. Early on in Jesse Winker's big league career, he was just absolutely killer 70% of the time and didn't play the other 30% of the time. He's sad. Right. And then he had like a cold streak. I remember, I think that was 2019. He had a cold streak in like 2019 or so, like May or so. And he just got like benched fully. And, you know, he wasn't playing the other time. So just it was over. We've worried about people like Brandon Lau getting potentially platooned because this is a great split, but it is ugly on the other side of things at times.
Yeah.
And if you go down the list here, you know, a lot of guys for like our understanding of who they are, like they end up being very different. Brandon Lau's a 270 hitter against righties. It's not surprising. Like Jared Walsh batted 333. Winker batted 346. A lot of these top guys are just insane. Like,
yeah.
Kyle Schwarber's batting average, 264. You think of him as like a batting average liability. I remember like a while ago whenever I was writing my piece about like the daily lineup system, a lot of it was actually driven by like, what if all of these platoon guys, you know, you could rotate them out of your lineups. So we go through this because I want to make sure we have a frame of reference for what really good for these people might be before we look up the ugly side of things. One of the things I pulled ahead of time today, and I pulled this for lefties, not for righties for a reason, but I pulled for lefties the league-wide splits for left-handed batters against both right-handed and left-handed pitching. So lefties against righties, the strong side of the platoon split, they had a league-wide batting average of 243. Not great, but they get shifted against. An OBP of 320, a slugging of 417, and then a WOBA of 320, which is like about starter average. So like lefties, generally speaking, on average, were pretty good. Now there's some people who aren't that good, lay this down. There's people who are really good, but bring this up. The thing about lefties is like a lot of them might only play against right-handed pitching. So when we flip it around the other side of things, lefties against lefties, the numbers are ugly, and these are probably the good ones. So the average, so the batting average is like 228, 300 OBP, 355 slugging for a 289 WOBA. That is bad. And these are, again, the ones who play. Now, for righties, the splits are a little bit different. Typically, if you're a righty who gets to bat against righties, that means you're playing full-time, you're probably a pretty good batter. Whereas the righties against lefties, like, that's the big side platoon split, but also there might be some platoon guys in there. So I'm going to pull those, and I pulled them, they were slightly better. But yeah, it's worth investigating this because there are a lot of guys that I'm vaguely interested in or curious about, or who are blocking someone I'm curious about.
Yeah.
Who have looked very good in limited roles. And some of them, I think maybe full-time role, they'd be able to survive it. Like Brandon Lau should play every day. Like what else are the Tampa Bay Rays going to do? They can platoon everyone, throw them.
Well,
there,
I think part of theirs is because they just like to get cute with everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, rest him once in a while if it is against a right, against a lefty, I guess. But, like, he shouldn't be part of a platoon, per se.
Here's something I want to throw out there just as a thought, and you can take it whatever way you want, and if you want to leave it dead on arrival, that's fine. But there's this thing that keeps running through my head. Number one, if you have somebody who's really good in a platoon situation and they get full playing time, you almost would have to expect that they're numbers, overall numbers, are going to come down because they're playing to their strengths. They're not playing to their weaknesses. On the other hand, what you see them do against a handful of relievers who come in and they don't get yanked is not necessarily what they could do against that side of the plate if they had more regular at-bats and could get into a groove and work on that weakness. So I when we're making these judgments about players who are on a side of a platoon, it's for a reason. Yes, I get that. I totally understand. And it can be very different when somebody knows that they have the role and they're going to get every day at bats and get those looks. They're going to probably still be worse than what they're, you know, the strong side of that split, but they could potentially be better than what they're showing you in very limited, small sample sizes when they're not seeing it all the time. They don't get the chance to grow and adjust and develop and adapt. So I think those are interesting elements here when we're talking about looking forward.
That is like an exceptionally good point. And I definitely think there are a couple of guys on the list of names I pulled ahead of time who fall very directly into that sort of situation. It's worth noting that I don't really care all that much, especially for the weak side of things, what people's specific platoon splits are. I do want to make sure we can have like a look at the top end in one particular season because it's fun. But like, yeah. It takes somewhere on the order of 3,000 career plate appearances for both sides to get like an accurate understanding what someone's like platoon splits are going to be in comparison to league average, just using that to regress things back. Like, it's not a science. It is a whole lot of just fuzz. Like, we're talking about like pitchers' home run rates being more meaningful. It's like, it just, it's ugly. So, and it's ugly exactly for the reason you brought up there. There isn't consistency. There isn't an ability for people to be one version of the self. So I actually want to start here with a guy that I don't think represents the rest of everyone else, but just fits so perfectly there what you brought up. I want to talk about Andrew Vaughn, who I really love, who did really well in some things last year, and who didn't look great for all of that last year. Now, did you roster Andrew Vaughn in any leagues? Did you have to deal with...
I did. Yes. Here's the thing, to go full circle to what I said at the beginning. What I did with Andrew Vaughn is useless information because it was, well, only because it went through that kind of dark period where I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't acting on things. So in some cases, I probably dropped him too quickly because I was chasing something and just wanted to get out of the app. And in other cases, I probably held on to him too long because I just wasn't managing. So I do remember not wanting to let him go, though, believing wholeheartedly that he was one good series away from just everything locking in. And I was going to have had him while he was not great and then dump him. And then somebody else was going to pick him up and benefit from his, you know, his turnaround.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember that.
He had an injury at the end of the year, which messed things up. But he also had Tony La Russa just yanking him out of lineups randomly, which messed him up. And he had learning to play the outfield on the fly, which probably didn't help at all. So there's just like no reasonable understanding of like baseball that would have like led to this being a conducive season for him.
Yeah.
The result, pretty not good. So I'm going to quote his platoon splits, and then I'm going to say LOL. He had a 938 OPS with a 383 OBP against lefties. He's right-handed. So that makes actually a lot of sense. He's the opposite of what we were talking about earlier. Yeah, he just crushed them. Against righties, who he got a surprising amount of run with, but never like consistent, like was the starter for a full week sort of stuff. It would always just be like randomly, like Leury Garcia would like get him bumped out, or just people off the street seemingly would walk into the White Sox lineup above him regularly. But he also had a 609 OPS against righties, which is very bad. But if you're a team's number three, or if you're the number three overall draft pick, a team's top pick and their top prospect, and you're debuting, you're going to get some run. And there were injuries, there were some other things. It's really important to note, and I like to pull him out as like a good case of what you brought up, how things changed as the season went on. So one of the things you can pull, I especially like this for strikeout rate, is you can pull his strikeout rate over the course of the season. I'm going to set it to be 100 PA rather than 50. Which tells a really interesting story. For his first 100 or so PA, he had like a 28% strikeout rate against everyone, mind you, not just righties, lefties. And that continued on for about the first 200, 250 plate appearances. Then, about half a season in, he started adjusting, and his strikeout rate dropped to about 15%. That is a figuring it out on the fly while figuring out how to play outfield defense on the fly adjustment that cut his strikeout rate by more than a third. The dude's really good. As a result, over the course of the year, his hard contact rate was just stellar. We're talking like 34-ish% for most of the year. Like, we're talking adjusting to make more contact and not losing the power as a result of it.
Right.
That's incredible. So I want to note that he's a guy that I think really tells the story of what could go right here. Where someone's good, they adjust, they get an opportunity, and maybe everything wasn't perfect under the hood, but he's definitely a guy that I am buying. He's on my RazSlam roster. He went for way too much, but not too much in this like dynasty startup auction that I had over the weekend, where he was like going near $20. And I mean, like, yeah, he's good. He'll probably pay out it off. It's just like, no discount.
people believe in it still. Right. So yeah. I just want to say that's why you should. Even though, and hilariously, if you look at his first half, second half splits, which he was injured, but like still, I just mentioned that thing about the strikeout rate changing. His post All-Star break OPS was 610 or 612. Mm. Like, that's really bad. Yeah. He had a 210 average and like a sub 300 OBP. Like that's not playable. But right. He was pretty unlucky, and the skills growth was actually kind of clear despite the opposite of results. So I'm intrigued. And I really hope
it also seems to be the trend. We've gotten so used to, and I think spoiled by the Juan Sotos who just come up and rake, that we have expected that from Kelnick, and we've expected that from Kirilloff, and we've expected that from Vaughn. And doing this at the major league level is really, really hard. It's just really difficult. Adjusting to a new city, new pressures, new positions, all of those things. Again, these are human beings. They are incredibly talented, elite baseball players who are human beings and are susceptible to burnout and overload and all of those things. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to think Andrew Vaughn didn't just suddenly get bad at baseball. You know, it's way more likely that he is going to come back and he's going to do what Rafael Devers did after his down year than he's going to be Keston Hira. You know, I think you have to look at those types of things and understand the narrative, and everything that you're talking about there makes perfect sense. Who are some other guys? Is there any pitchers you want to talk about in terms of this? I think it's important to look at both sides of the ball, you know?
Yeah. There are a lot of guys that I feel like are kind of like flexing in and out of rotations, and like they're going to start for a lot of the year. That's just going to be the reality. Like, I feel like a good person to talk about that going the other way though is Christian Javier for the Astros, who has kind of been somewhere between a starter and a reliever for a couple years now. I remember watching the Astros a lot because I was covering them essentially during the 2020 playoffs. And yep. The Astros did not have a good bullpen that year. They made it, as they seemingly always do, pretty far. And he was basically one of two players that was trusted at all in 2020. So there'd be a lot of games where someone would pitch somewhere around four or five innings. Then he'd pitch the rest of them until they handed the ball off to Presley in the last inning.
Yeah.
So Javier was definitely a guy who had that role thrust upon him late in the year and looked pretty good in it. They had a lot of people who were kind of around. Remember Framber came up and Urquidy was around, and, you know, I think in 2020, yeah, aside from one start, McCullers was really solid. Greinke was around. So like they had like a decimated rotation after losing both Verlander and Cole, but they ended up with six arms in the playoffs, which is incredible. Like,
yeah,
their ability to just like spit out arms has been incredible. And then this last year, you know, they signed Odorizzi and Luis Garcia appeared, and Javier went to the bullpen. He pitched 100 innings last year, which is really wild. But he started the year in the rotation, and he finished it not on the best note. There's some wonders about what happened to his command that could be answered depending on how you feel about things. But he's a guy that I want to point to as kind of like existing and working on things in a little bit different way than you might have kind of expected. So I'm going to pull his splits by month because I can get game starts by month. So yeah, in April, he had a 0.87 ERA across four starts.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's very good. Yep.
26 strikeouts against 79 batters. That's like more than a 30% strikeout rate. He walked six batters. So we're looking at somewhere around a 7-8% strike or walk rate. And he has a sub one whip. And then things fell apart in May. He had five starts, 4.5 ERA, 1.16 whip, which isn't great. The strikeouts weren't quite there, but they were still pretty good. And the walks ticked up considerably. Walked 17 batters out of 131 for like a walk rate that's close to 12. And it kind of stuck near there all year. But he was really good despite it, because in his bullpen role, his ability to kind of just like walk the one guy that he couldn't get after and then just strike out other people and get outs around them is more viable because you aren't expected to like save yourself for the fifth inning. As a result, I have no idea what to do with his performance. Now, His October was terrible. His September was terrible. His basically everything post All-Star was terrible. And he wasn't great in, he wasn't terrible, but he wasn't great in the postseason either. So I don't know where to place him. There are, you know, some confusing signs in there. He walked just a ton of guys throughout the entire year. But as a young pitcher, I think trying to make sense of who he might be rather than who he could be, like who he might be right now, based off of these very different samples with different approaches and like thinking about what he can do differently, tasking him with different things, is very confusing. So I don't bring him up as someone who I have answers for. I do think that, you know, an off season of work, which I don't know that he's necessarily had because of the lockout, right? And also, notably, the Astros are changing pitching coaches. Brent Strom's gone. He's off to Arizona. There's the capacity for Christian Javier to be a different pitcher. I don't know that we're going to see the fully formed version of him this year. But he's a guy that I'm very interested in long-term because he's been in the majors for a while, and he's only 24.
Yeah, especially if we don't have to get into this too hardcore. We might get to it quickly as an off the books in a minute here. But if the CBA gets settled sooner than later, which who knows, McCullers did have a setback in his situation. So I think you would get a chance to see how Javier starts the year. That obviously doesn't help in drafts, but you could get a sense of what his approach is. Really, it's obviously going to be a small sample size, but you might see a change in, say, pitch mix or effectiveness of a certain pitch early on, or location, or approach in trying to go after guys. You know, as we've talked about, getting that first strike is a big deal. You did a lot of work in terms of looking at eventual outcomes and things like that, in terms of like CSW and all that. So if he can make those choices in different ways, maybe because of the coach, maybe because he's a year older, maybe because he's got a better idea of what's working and what's not. And I really feel like a lot of these guys who have good talent and have those kind of wonky results, it's probably just a tweak, or it's maybe a telegraphing of some sort, or you know, digging in and looking at film and you know, I'm just missing off the outside corner on a lot of these pitches, but everybody knows I'm just missing, so they take them. If a couple more of those start being strikes, maybe that opens up a lot more swing and miss stuff, because people are going to chase a little bit, because there is the chance that it could be a, there's so many ways that it could go right for somebody like that who has the talent and has shown the talent. I certainly think, given the fact that unless the lockout lasts so long that McCullers kind of comes back from his setback, he's going to get an opportunity.
Yeah. It being confused by him is seemingly normal. Here I have his like Savant player comps, which are really funny. He has 2020 Justin Dunn and 2020 Eliezer Hernandez, who are not people you want to be compared to in terms of like things all that much. Like, the results have not been there for them. He also has 2021 Bailey Ober, 2021 Jose Urquidy, which are, I guess, okay comps, and 2021 Freddy Peralta.
That's
I don't know, man. Do I need to be worried about Freddy Peralta?
I know, right? What does that actually mean? Yeah that's, I mean, in terms of whether those comps are helpful, I think we can, let's make that a very quick pass fail. Those comps fail. That's not really very helpful at all.
It's wild. So yeah, Javier is a guy that I'm watching. He also,
do you want to maybe just in terms of time here, just kind of talk about a few other people that you think fall into this
there
category?
There were and several.
People can kind of dig into the stats and the data themselves, but other people who are good symbols or exemplify what you're talking about.
Yeah. Adbert Alzolay is another guy who pitched in the rotation for a while, wasn't great, went to the bullpen and was in his bullpen role able to tinker with his pitch mix and add some stuff, and was really effective there. Part of that also, and this is kind of the thing that I'm worried about, is if you're in the bullpen, you can kind of like tap into some velo a little bit better, and a lot of people's stuff is a whole lot better with a tick or two more velocity.
Yeah.
He probably goes back to the rotation next year. The Cubs need to give him a chance
because they need to finally create a pitcher. The Cubs have not like created a pitcher in like a decade, it feels like. So he's a guy I'm interested in. Tanner Houck's a guy I love. He's his stuff out of the rotation was phenomenal last year. It just kind of feels like there's a possibility he becomes kind of like a paired like long man or something like that, just because they don't feel like he can, you know, be a full-time starter. They don't want to risk it in there in Boston. But I really want him to get the opportunity, and he's a guy where I feel like the lack of role doesn't scare me, because he's shown me he can be good as a starter when you look just at his starter numbers, and that's the sort of thing that I want to be doing. Some other guys, Patino in Tampa Bay, I'm curious about. I don't know. He's obviously young. It's an offseason. Typically things change a whole lot. And then Garrett Whitlock, another guy who, like, is he going to get turned into a starter? Is he going to stay as, like, their fireman? Boston's confusing. There's a lot of guys whose roles are in flux there. I buy Whitlock as a reliever, that I will say. No matter the role, I think he can be good as a reliever. But I have no idea if that will translate as a starter. So those are all pitchers who are like, they are on my mind as I'm going late through these Raz Slam situations, or like trying to figure out who I maybe want to take, you know, post pick 300 in TGFBI to round out a roster. It's all tough, right? But you got to take some selective bets. And those are all guys who, even if I'm not buying all of the bets, the challenge of figuring them out is going to be difficult. And part of what we need to make sure we're doing correctly is not just like strictly looking at the overall, because it's not going to tell the full picture for a lot of them.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to be rolling dice, you might as well try and weight them a little bit, right? Make at least an educated guess rather than just a complete dart throw. Let's hit this off the books quick. We are at an hour. We'll definitely not belabor this point, especially not in the traditional way, but I'd like to go off the books and talk a little bit about the CBA and the negotiations that are going on, not from the typical, the owners stink, Rob Manfred is awful. Those things are all accepted and true. But I think one of the things that's really important that we bring up and hopefully is becomes more of this narrative. I think we see it in our circles because we are, you know, in this Twitterverse with a bunch of other people doing the kinds of things that we're doing that are in baseball all the time, even in the off season as well. But kind of the narrative that's out there and our media literacy as it relates to what we're seeing and hearing and understanding the sources. I try really hard not to jump into the fray with these things because I'm not winning hearts and minds on Twitter. I know that there's probably a thousand things that I want to say that might stir the pot that for every one that I actually do. And even the one that I put out there usually is fairly mild, but I forget which one of the MLB mouthpieces it was the other day. It kind of just said, you know, like, well, I have a source who says that they're really feeling optimistic about this thing. And, you know, one of the players who's in the room quote tweeted it saying, this is just not true. And people kind of went after him. And rightfully so, you know, he's like, well, I mean, it's the opinion of my source.
Oh, that was John actually, Heyman. Yeah.
John Heyman. Yeah. Yep. I actually couldn't stop myself from responding and saying the opinion of somebody in the room who's feeding it to you so that you will go and say exactly what you said, because that narrative is beneficial to one side of the argument. That doesn't make it true. It's actually really irresponsible reporting. Now, if you understand that he feeds his family by getting a paycheck from, I don't know if it's directly from Major League Baseball, but like, you know, he's obviously wants to stay ingratiated to the owners and, you know, the commissioner's office and all of that. Like, at some point,
he's MLB
though,
Network.
You lose,
so,
yeah. Okay. So directly from MLB, you lose all of your credibility, all of it. It's gone. So it's almost like just stop saying things, because people who don't understand that are now seeing this. And it's working. It works to make people think that, well, I guess the owners are really trying very hard and it's the players who are being very, very difficult. When in reality, it's the owners who have been negotiating in bad faith from the very beginning. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating that these people who sell themselves as reporters, who are using social media to self-publish news reports aren't reporting the news at all. It's 100% just reiterating the talking points that benefit Major League Baseball and the commissioner's office. And it's frustrating. So there it is. I'm off my soapbox.
Having existed around a lot of people who do reporting and beat reporting versus scoops reporting, you're kind of like weird different things. But it's like they're definitely different niches in like the journalistic realm to kind of pay attention to.
Yes,
there are the guys who exist to be first in Twitter. You know, it's like I don't necessarily think of like in the NBA terms like Shams and Waj as people who are like there to carry water, because like they've kind of monopolized it, and I imagine they get a lot of their sourcing actually from agents and stuff like that. That wouldn't surprise me at all. On the MLB side, a lot of the scoops reporters though are definitely having connections through front offices. Bob Nightingale kind of infamously like is gonna just like text up what some people send him, but like does seem like he has legitimate sourcing, especially close to the White Sox, it seems, that is accurate and really useful in some cases. Bob definitely kind of
he's also easily manipulated through those same channels.
But I don't think Bob was like kind of like maliciously shilling in the same way that some of the people seem like they are almost actively doing so. And I want to differentiate there. However, there are, in addition to like those outright scoops people, there are a whole lot of team beat reporters on the ground. And there's some people that I like fill my Twitter feed with who did a really good job of reporting live from negotiations without a whole lot of spin, or with this sort of like, yeah, this is just reality and I have to tell it you that way. That's how it is. I mean, Jeff Passan does a lot of scoops-ish stuff, but he also tends to act in my mind a lot like a beat reporter in some ways.
Yeah,
and like the way he kind of talks about things is very much talking about functional stuff. It's not just first, it's like what are the implications in like a four-year team sort of way. But then like you go down, like Chandler Rome is the Astros beat reporter for the Eastern Chronicle. He was doing some just solid here's what's going on without any of like the like editorializing that just kind of like takes away from the fact that it's like, yeah, they walk back sort of way. And then there are some beat reporters who just know that part of their job is to do the sort of like, no, like this is what the reality actually is. My sources aren't just the FO, which is going to help you actually understand things better. I think, who is it? Lindsay Adler for the Yankees for the Athletic does a fantastic job of that. And then on top of that, there are the people whose just job is to straight editorialize, like Jim Bowden, GM.
Yeah. Oh, man. My goodness.
and I really want to say, like, people who are what you would consider journalists, who work for a newspaper or whatever it is that has replaced your newspaper, who do actual reporting, are people who are like those beat reporters, and they're doing, by and large, a really good job. They are also not the people who have the largest Twitter following.
Right.
Does seem to me, though, if you're the person who's going to learn about this through your local paper and like, you know, you're 50 years old, chances are that beat reporter who's talking about things is kind of changed their tune of lately. And it's probably just like the facts on the page say that this is what it is. Like there was no like even fake optimism. So I don't know if this like AstroTurf PR campaign through scoops reporters who are beholden to front office is going to work. It seems to me that most people have read the room that are not like who are like plugged in like us. And I will say who were the people who typically go to games pretty frequently. I don't know how much we need to specifically care about how the personal opinion of someone who is not going to buy a ticket no matter what is here. The whales, so to speak, the people who buy season tickets or whatever, like who, what do they think and where do they get their information from? And, you know, like people who buy merch, you know, like the growing markets, where do they get the information from? So that's what I'm curious about.
Well, it's even the AP the other day, they're the ones that had the headline, you know, Max Scherzer shows up for negotiations in his Porsche. Like that is very clearly a headline that is meant to say really, really rich guy shows up unhappy about not making more money. And nobody's talking about the owners helicoptering in, right? Or like however they get there. They're certainly not probably, I mean, I don't know, maybe they are, but driving like a 92 Camry to these negotiations, right? Like you're talking about sure, if Max Scherzer can drive his Porsche because he's so wealthy, you're still talking about owners that are 10, 20, 30 times fold more wealthy than Max Scherzer. And yeah, we're not talking about what they're driving. It's just so frustrating. And I was very proud to see a lot of people kind of pounce on that, but that's an AP headline. That should not be. It should not exist like that.
Yeah. I think, you know, even taking that a step further, if you have to live in this sort of like sad world that we do, you have to attempt to try to learn from it. And it's telling, though, that like these things get like ignored hours later. But if you go back through, like, for example, like PL Discord, I like went and scrolled through like the stuff overnight, or I went and scrolled through like MLB news channel to see like who had reported which things. No, we tend to have a don't post Heyman in there as if it's news sort of like bent among people who are posting those things in there. And it does seem to me as though like that immediately after when everyone basically pulled the rug out and said, no, the players are voting no, they don't like this, they have not liked this all along.
Right.
There has been a steady stream of people like Evan Drellich for the Athletic, who's doing a pretty good job of just saying like they are far apart. This thing that has been offered, if you watch carefully, are coming from a couple sources who seem like they're reporting out what seems to be like too big to be true. But if you just take on the whole, a flood of information, John Heyman tweet about, oh, the offer might look like this, 300-400 more tweets, they've walked back and forth, that you're going to want to pounce on that. So it's just a nice reminder. It's like, this is the reality. Not everyone can be believed. Not everyone's job is to be right necessarily. And that sucks.
Yeah, I suppose I probably shouldn't be mad at John Heyman for doing basically what he's paid to do.
Yeah.
I guess I'm frustrated at the fact that it's being sold as something that it's not. And I guess that's our world of consumer information these days. It's not limited to baseball.
What I would say is don't get mad at people who are doing a different job and doing it very well, I will say. And like, don't blame Chandler Rome. Don't blame, I got slightly mad at Rosenthal, like, because you kind of like said both sides were bad in an argument earlier this week where he's like, here, just agree on this thing, which is kind of dumb. And then it seems like even he has been chipped away at. So yeah, we'll see. I do think that moments like these have value in really showing kind of like what a lot of sort of institutional reporting people are like. And by and large, most of them are not doing really terrible things, but the people who have a lot of followers who might be the top of your feed, you make some choices there if you need to.
Just understand the context, yeah. I guess. Buyer beware, consumer beware, reader beware. And on that note, that very happy, positive note, Alexander, that brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you for joining me, as always. I guess if you could just let the people know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.